When he got back to the house, he went immediately to the shower, as a boy named Pete Saubers would do many years later in this very same bathroom after visiting that very same embankment and overhanging tree. Morris stayed in until his fingers were pruney and the hot water was gone, then dried off and dressed in fresh clothes from his bedroom closet. They looked childish and out of fashion to him, but they still fit, more or less. He put his dirt-smeared jeans and sweatshirt in the washer, an act that would also be replicated by Pete Saubers years later. Morris turned on the TV, sat in his father's old easy chair. His mother said she kept it as a reminder, should she ever be tempted into stupidity again, and saw the usual helping of ad-driven inanity. He thought that any of those ads, jumping laxative bottles, primping moms, singing hamburgers, could have been written by Jimmy Gold, and that made his headache worse than ever. He decided to go down to Zoni's and get some Anison, maybe even a beer or two. Beer wouldn't hurt. It was the hard stuff that caused trouble, and he'd learned his lesson on that score. He did get the Anison, but the idea of drinking beer in a house full of books he didn't want to read and TV he didn't want to watch made him feel worse than ever, especially when the stuff he did want to read was so maddeningly close. Morris rarely drank in bars, but all at once he felt that if he didn't get out and find some company and hear some fast music, he would go completely insane. Somewhere out in this rainy night, he was sure there was a young lady who wanted to dance. He paid for his aspirin and asked the young guy at the register, almost idly, if there was a bar with live music that he could get to on the bus. The young guy said there was. 2010. When Linda Saubers got home that Friday afternoon at 3:30, Pete was sitting at the kitchen table drinking a cup of cocoa. His hair was still damp from the shower. She hung her coat on one of the hooks by the back door and placed the inside of her wrist against his forehead again. "Cool as a cucumber," she pronounced. "Do you feel better?" "Yeah," he said. "When Tina came home, I made her peanut butter crackers." "You're a good brother. Where is she now?"
"Ellen's. Where else?"
Linda rolled her eyes, and Pete laughed.
"Mother of mercy, is that the dryer, I hear?"
"Yeah, there were a bunch of clothes in the basket, so I washed them. Don't worry, I followed the directions on the door, and they came out okay." She bent down and kissed his temple. "Aren't you the little doobie?" "I try," Pete said. He closed his right hand to hide the blister on his palm. The first envelope came on a snow-showery Thursday not quite a week later. The address, Mr. Thomas Saubers, 23 Sycamore Street, was typed. Stuck on the upper right-hand corner was a 44-cent stamp featuring the Year of the Tiger. There was no return address on the upper left. Tom, the only member of Clan Saubers home at midday, tore it open in the hall, expecting either some sort of come-on or another past-due notice. God knew there had been plenty of those lately. But it wasn't a come-on, and it wasn't a past-due. It was money. The rest of the mail, catalogs for expensive stuff they couldn't afford and advertising circulars addressed to occupant, fell from his hand and fluttered around his feet unnoticed. In a low voice, almost a growl, Tom Sauber said, "What the fuck is this?" When Linda came home, the money was sitting in the middle of the kitchen table. Tom was seated before the neat little pile with his chin resting on his folded hands. He looked like a general considering a battle plan.
"What's that?" Linda asked.
$500. He continued to look at the bills, 850s and 520s. It came in the mail.
"From who?"
"I don't know." She dropped her briefcase, came to the table, and picked up the stack of currency. She counted it, then looked at him with wide eyes.
"My God, Tommy, what did the letter say?"
"There was no letter, just the money."
"But who would..."
"I don't know, Lynn, but I know one thing."
"What?"
"We can sure use it."
"Holy shit," Pete said when they told him.
He had stayed late at school for intramural volleyball and didn't come in until almost dinner time.
Don't be vulgar, Linda said, sounding distracted. The money was still on the kitchen table.
How much?
And when his father told him,
who sent it?
That's a good question, Tom said. Now for double jeopardy, where the scores can really change.
It was the first joke Pete had heard him make in a very long time.
Tina came in.
Daddy's got a fairy godmother, that's what I think. Hey, Dad, Mom, look at my fingernails. Ellen got sparkle polish and she shared.
Excellent look for you, my little pumpkin, Tom said.
First a joke, then a compliment. Those things were all it took to convince Pete that he had done the right thing.
Totally the right thing.
They couldn't exactly send it back, could they? Not without a return address, they couldn't. And by the way, when was the last time Dad had called teens his little pumpkin? Linda gave her son a piercing look.
You don't know anything about this, do you?
Uh-uh. But can I have some?
Dream on, she said, and turned to her husband, hands on hips. Tom, someone's obviously made a mistake. Tom considered this, and when he spoke, there was no arcing and barking. His voice was calm. That doesn't seem likely. He pushed the envelope toward her, tapping his name and address.
Yes, but me no buts, Lynn. We owe the oil company, and before we pay them, we have to pay down your MasterCard, or you're going to lose it.
Yes, but... Lose the credit card, lose your credit rating. Still not arcing and barking. Calm and reasonable. Persuasive. To Pete, it was as if his father had been suffering from a high fever that had just broken. He even smiled and touched her hand.
It so happens that for now your credit rating is the only one we've got, so we have to protect it. Besides, Tina could be right. Maybe I've got a fairy godmother.
No, Pete thought. A fairy godson is what you've got.
Tina said, oh, wait, I know where it really came from.
They turned to her. Pete felt suddenly warm all over. She couldn't know, could she? How could she? Only he'd said that stupid thing about buried treasure and...
Where, hun? Linda asked. The emergency fund thingy. It must have got some more money, and now they're spreading it out.
Pete let out a soundless breath of air, only realizing as it passed his lips that he had been holding it.
Tom ruffled her hair.
They wouldn't send cash, Bunkin. They'd send a check. Also a bunch of forms to sign.
Pete went to the stove. I'm making more cocoa. Does anyone want some?
Turned out they all did. The envelopes kept coming. The price of postage went up, but the amount never changed. An extra $6,000 per annum, give or take. Not a huge sum, but tax-free and just enough to keep the Saubers family from drowning in debt. The children were forbidden to tell anyone.
Tina will never be able to keep it to herself, Linda told Tom one night. You know that, don't you? She'll tell her idiot friend, and Ellen Briggs will broadcast it to everyone she knows.
But Tina kept the secret, partly because her brother, whom she idolized, told her she would never be allowed in his room again if she spilled the beans, and mostly because she remembered the Arky Barkies.
Pete stowed the cash envelopes in the cobweb-festooned hollow behind a loose baseboard in his closet. Once every 4 weeks or so, he took out $500 and put it in his backpack along with an addressed envelope, one of several dozen he had prepared at school on a computer in the school's business headroom. He did the envelopes after intramurals one late afternoon when the room was empty. He used a variety of city mailboxes to send them on their way to Mr. Thomas Saubers of 23 Sycamore Street, going about this family-sustaining charity with the craft of a master criminal. He was always afraid that his mom would discover what he was up to, object, probably strenuously, and things would go back to the way they had been. Things weren't perfect now, there was still the occasional arky barky, but he supposed things weren't perfect in any family outside those old TV sitcoms on Nick at Night. They could watch Nick at Night, and Cartoon Network, and MTV, and everything else, because, ladies and gentlemen, the cable was back. In May, another good thing happened. Dad got a part-time job with a new real estate company as something called a pre-sell investigator. Pete didn't know what that was and didn't give shit one.
Dad could do it on his phone and the home computer. It brought in a little money, and those were the things that mattered. Two other things mattered in the months after the money started coming in. Dad's legs were getting better, that was one thing. In June of 2010, when the perpetrator of the so-called City Center massacre was finally caught, Tom began walking without his crutches some of the time, and he also began stepping down on the pink pills. The other thing was more difficult to explain, but Pete knew it was there. So did Tina. Dad and Mom felt, well, blessed. And now when they argued, they looked guilty as well as mad, as if they were shitting on the mysterious good fortune that had befallen them. Often they would stop and talk about other things before the shit got deep. Often it was the money they talked about and who could be sending it. These discussions came to nothing, and that was good. I will not be caught, Pete told himself. I must not, and I will not. One day in August of that year, Dad and Mom took Tina and Ellen to a petting zoo called Happydale Farm. This was the opportunity Pete had been patiently waiting for, and as soon as they were gone, he went back to the stream with two suitcases. After making sure the coast was clear, he dug the trunk out of the embankment again and loaded the notebooks into the suitcases. He reburied the trunk and then went back to the house with his booty. In the upstairs hall, he pulled down the ladder and carried the suitcases up to the attic. This was a small, low space, chilly in winter and stifling in summer. The family rarely used it. Their extra stuff was still stored in the garage. The few relics up here were probably left over from one of the previous families that had owned 23 Sycamore. There was a dirty baby carriage listing on one wheel, a standing lamp with tropical birds on the shade, old issues of Red Book and Good Housekeeping tied up with twine, a pile of moldy blankets that smelled like yuck. Pete piled the notebooks in the farthest corner and covered them with the blankets. But first he grabbed one at random, sat under one of the attic's two hanging light bulbs, and opened it. The writing was cursive and quite small, but carefully made and easy to read. There were no crossouts, which Pete thought remarkable. Although he was looking at the first page of the notebook, the small circled number at the top was 482, making him think that this was continued not just from one of the other notebooks, but from half a dozen. Half a dozen at least. Chapter 27. The back room of the Drover was the same as it had been 5 years before. The same smell of ancient beer mingled with the stink of the stockyards and the tang of diesel from the trucking depots that fronted this half of Nebraska's great emptiness. Stu Logan looked the same, too. Here was the same white apron, the same suspiciously black hair, even the same parrots and macaws necktie strangling his rosy neck. "Why, it's Jimmy Gold, as I live and breathe," he said and smiled in his old dislikable way that said, "We don't care for each other, but let's pretend. Have you come to pay me what you owe, then?" "I have," Jimmy said, and touched his back pocket where the pistol rested. It felt small and final, a thing capable, if used correctly and with courage, of paying all debts. "Then step in," Logan said. "Have a drink. You look dusty." "I am," Jimmy said, and along with a drink I could use... A horn honked on the street. Pete jumped and looked around guiltily as if he'd been whacking off instead of reading. What if they'd come home early because that doofus Ellen had gotten carsick or something? What if they found him up here with the notebooks? Everything could fall apart. He shoved the one he had been reading under the old blankets. Phew, they stank! And crawled back to the trap door, sparing a glance for the suitcases. No time for them. Going down the ladder, the change in temperature from boiling hot to August normal made him shiver. Pete folded the ladder and shoved it up, wincing at the squeak and bang the trapdoor made when it snapped shut on its rusty spring. He went into his bedroom and peered out at the driveway. Nobody there. False alarm. Thank God. He returned to the attic and retrieved the suitcases. He put them back in the downstairs closet, took a shower, once more remembering to clean up the tub afterwards, then dressed in clean clothes and lay down on his bed. He thought, it's a novel. With that many pages, it's pretty much gotta be. And there might be more than one because no single novel's long enough to fill all those books. Not even the Bible would fill all those books. Also, it was interesting. He wouldn't mind hunting through the notebooks and finding the one where it started, seeing if it really was good. Because you couldn't tell if a novel was good from just a single page, could you? Pete closed his eyes and began to drift napward. Ordinarily, he wasn't much of a day sleeper, but it had been a busy morning. The house was empty and quiet, and he decided to let himself go. Why not? Everything was right, at least right now, and that was his doing. He deserved a nap. That name, though. Jimmy Gold. Pete could swear he'd heard it before. In class, maybe? Mrs. Swidrowski giving them background on one of the authors they were reading? Maybe. She liked to do that. Maybe I'll Google it later on, Pete thought. I could do that. I could. He slept. 1978. Morris sat on a steel bunk with his throbbing head lowered and his hands dangling between his orange-clad thighs, breathing in a poison atmosphere of piss, puke, and disinfectant. His stomach was a lead ball that seemed to have expanded until it filled him from crotch to Adam's apple. His eyes pulsed in their sockets. His mouth tasted like a dumpster. His gut ached and his face hurt. His sinuses were stuffed. Somewhere a hoarse and despairing voice was chanting, I need a lover that won't drive me crazy. I need a lover that won't drive me crazy. I need a lover that won't drive me crazy.
Shut up, someone shouted. You're driving me crazy, asshole.
A pause then.
I need a lover that won't drive me crazy.
The lead in Morris's belly liquefied and gurgled. He slid off the bunk, landed on his knees, provoking a fresh bolt of agony in his head, and hung his gaping mouth over the functional steel toilet. For a moment, there was nothing. Then everything clenched, and he ejected what looked like 2 gallons of yellow toothpaste. For a moment, the pain in his head was so huge that he thought it would simply explode. And in that moment, Morris hoped it would. Anything to end the pain. Instead of dying, he threw up again. A pint instead of a gallon this time. But it burned. The next one was a dry heave. Wait, not completely dry. Thick strings of mucus hung from his lips like cobwebs swinging back and forth. He had to brush them away.
Somebody's feeling it.
A voice shouted. Shouts and cackles of laughter greeted this sally. To Morris, it sounded as if he were locked up in a zoo, and he supposed he was, only this was the kind where the cages held humans. The orange jumpsuit he was wearing proved it. How had he gotten here? He couldn't remember, any more than he could remember how he'd gotten into the house he'd trashed in Sugar Heights. What he could remember was his own house on Sycamore Street, and the trunk, of course, burying the trunk. There had been money in his pocket, $200 of John Rothstein's money, and he had gone down to Zoni's to get a couple of beers because his head ached and he was feeling lonely. He had talked to the clerk, he was pretty sure of that, but he couldn't remember what they had discussed. Baseball? Probably not. He had a groundhog's cap, but that was as far as his interests went. After that, almost nothing. All he could be sure of was that something had gone horribly wrong. When you woke up wearing an orange jumpsuit, that was an easy deduction to make. He crawled back to the bunk, pulled himself up, drew his knees to his chest, and clasped his hands around them. It was cold in the cell. He began to shiver.
I might have asked that clerk what his favorite bar was, one I could get to on the bus. And I went there, didn't I? Went there and got drunk, in spite of all I know about what it does to me. Not just a little loaded, either. Standing up, falling down, shit-faced drunk. Oh, yes, undoubtedly, in spite of all he knew. Which was bad, but he couldn't remember the crazy things afterwards, and that was worse. After the third drink, sometimes only second, he fell down a dark hole and didn't climb back out until he woke up hungover but sober. Blackout drinking was what they called it, and in those blackouts, he almost always got up to, well, call it hijinks. Hijinks was how he'd ended up in Riverview Youth Detention, and doubtless how he'd ended up here, wherever here was. Hijinks. Fucking hijinks. Morris hoped it had been a good old-fashioned bar fight and not more breaking and entering, not a repeat of his Sugar Heights adventure, in other words, because he was well past his teenage years now and it wouldn't be the reformatory this time, no sir. Still, he would do the time if he had done the crime. Just as long as the crime had nothing to do with the murder of a certain genius American writer, please God. If it did, he would not be breathing free air again for a long time. Maybe never. Because it wasn't just Rothstein, was it? And now a memory did arise. Curtis Rogers asking if New Hampshire had the death penalty. Morris lay on the bunk, shivering, thinking, that can't be why I'm here. It can't. Can it? He had to admit that it was possible, and not just because the police might have put him together with the dead men in the rest area. He could see himself in a bar or a strip joint somewhere. Morris Bellamy, the college dropout and self-proclaimed American lit scholar tossing back bourbon and having an out-of-body experience. Someone starts talking about the murder of John Rothstein, the great writer, the reclusive American genius. And Morris Bellamy, drunk off his tits and full of that huge anger he usually kept locked in a cage, that black beast with the yellow eyes, turning to the speaker and saying, he didn't look much like a genius when I blew his head off. I would never, he whispered. His head was aching worse than ever, and there was something wrong on the left side of his face, too. It burned. I would never. Only how did he know that? When he drank, any day was anything can happen day. The black beast came out. As a teenager, the beast had rampaged through that house in Sugar Heights, tearing the motherfucker pretty much to shreds. And when the cops responded to the siren's alarm, he had fought them until one belted him unconscious with his nightstick. And when they searched him, they found a shitload of jewelry in his pockets, much of it of the costume variety, but some carelessly left out of Madame's safe, extraordinarily valuable. And howdy do, off we go to Riverview, where we will get our tender young buttsky reamed and make exciting new friends. He thought, the person who put on a shit show like that is perfectly capable of boasting while drunk about murdering Jimmy Gold's creator, and you know it. Although it could have been the cops, too. If they had ID'd him and put out an APB, that was just as likely.
I need a lover who won't drive me crazy.
Shut up! This time it was Morris himself, and he tried to yell it, but what came out was nothing but a puke-clotted croak. Oh, his head hurt. And his face, yow! He ran a hand up his left cheek and stared stupidly at the flakes of dried blood in his palm. He explored again and felt scratches there, at least three of them. Fingernail scratches, and deep. What does that tell us, class? Well, ordinarily, although there are exceptions to every rule, men punch and women scratch. The ladies do it with their nails because more often than not they have nice long ones to scratch with. Did I try to slap the make on some twist and she refused me with her nails? Morris tried to remember and couldn't.
He remembered the rain, the poncho, and the flashlight shining on the roots. He remembered the pick. He sort of remembered wanting to hear fast, loud music and talking to the clerk at Zoni's Go-Mart. After that, just darkness. He thought, maybe it was the car. That damn Biscayne. Maybe somebody saw it coming out of the rest area on Route 92 with the front end all bloody on the right, and maybe I left something in the glove compartment. Something with my name on it. But that didn't seem likely. Freddy had purchased the Chevy from a half-drunk bar bitch in a Lynn tap room, paying with money the three of them had pooled. She had signed over the pink to Harold Feynman, which happened to be the name of Jimmy Gold's best friend in the runner. She had never seen Morris Bellamy, who knew enough to stay out of sight while that particular deal went down. Besides, Morris had done everything but soap "Please Steal Me" on the windshield when he left it at the mall. No, the Biscayne was now sitting in a vacant lot somewhere, either in Low Town or down by the lake, stripped to the axles. So how did I wind up here? Back to that, like a rat running on a wheel. If some woman marked my face with her nails, did I haul off on her? Maybe break her jaw? That rang a faint bell behind the blackout curtains. If it were so, then he was probably going to be charged with assault and he might go up to Waynesville for it. A ride in the big green bus with the wire mesh on the windows. Waynesville would be bad, but he could do a few years for assault if he had to. Assault was not murder. Please, don't let it be Rothstein, he thought. I've got a lot of reading to do. It's stashed away, all safe and waiting. The beauty part is, I've got money to support myself with while I do it. More than $20,000 in unmarked 20s and 50s. That will last quite a while, if I live small. So please, don't let it be murder.
I need a lover who won't drive me crazy.
One more time, motherfucker, someone shouted. One more time and I'll pull your asshole right out through your mouth.
Morris closed his eyes. Although he was feeling better by noon, he refused the slop that passed for lunch. Noodles floating in what appeared to be blood sauce. Then around 2 o'clock, a quartet of guards came down the aisle between the cells. One had a clipboard and was shouting names.
Bellamy, Holloway, MacGyver, Riley, Roosevelt, Titgarden, step forward.
That's Teagarden, sir, said the large black man in the box next to Morris's.
I don't give a shit if it's John Q. Motherfucker. If you want to talk to your court-appointed, step forward. If you don't, sit there and stack more time.
The half-dozen named prisoners stepped forward. They were the last ones left, at least in this corridor. The others brought in the previous night, mercifully including the fellow who had been butchering John Mellencamp, had either been released or taken to court for the morning arraignment. They were the small fry. Afternoon arraignments, Morris knew, were for more serious shit. He had been arraigned in the afternoon after his little adventure in Sugar Heights. Judge Bukowski, that cunt. Morris prayed to a god he did not believe in as the door of his holding cell snapped back. Assault god, okay? Simple, not ag, just not murder. God, let them know nothing about what went down in New Hampshire or at a certain rest area in upstate New York, okay? That okay with you?
Step out, boys, the guard with the clipboard said. Step out and face right. Arms linked from the upstanding American in front of you. No wedgies, no reach-arounds. Don't fuck with us and we will return the favor.
They went down in an elevator big enough to hold a small herd of cattle, then along another corridor, and then, God knew why, they were wearing sandals and the jumpsuits had no pockets, through a metal detector. Beyond that was a visitor's room with 8 walled booths like library carrels. The guard with the clipboard directed Morris to number 3. Morris sat down and faced his court-appointed through plexiglass that had been smeared often and wiped seldom. The guy on the freedom side was a nerd with a bad haircut and a dandruff problem. He had a cold sore below one nostril and a scuffed briefcase sitting on his lap.
He looked like he might be all of 19. This is what I get, Morris thought. Oh, Jesus, this is what I get. The lawyer pointed to the phone on the wall of Morris's booth and opened his briefcase. From it, he removed a single sheet of paper and the inevitable yellow legal pad. Once these were on the counter in front of him, he put his briefcase on the floor and picked up his own phone. He spoke not in the tentative tenor of your usual adolescent, but in a confident, husky baritone that seemed far too big for the chicken chest lurking behind the purple rag of his tie.
You're in deep shit, mister.
He looked at the sheet lying on top of his legal pad.
Bellamy, you must prepare for a very long stay in the state penitentiary, I think. Unless you have something to trade, that is.
Morris thought. He's talking about trading the notebooks. Coldness went marching up his arms like the feet of evil fairies. If they had him for Rothstein, they had him for Curtis and Freddy. That meant life with no possibility of parole. He would never be able to retrieve the trunk, never find out Jimmy Gold's ultimate fate.
Speak, the lawyer said, as if talking to a dog.
Then tell me who I'm speaking to.
Elmer Cafferty, temporarily at your service. You're going to be arraigned in... He looked at his watch, a Timex even cheaper than his suit. 30 minutes. Judge Bukowski is very prompt.
A bolt of pain that had nothing to do with his hangover went through Morris's head. No, not her. It can't be. That bitch came over on the Ark.
Cafferty smiled. I deduce you've had doings with the great Bukowski before.
Check your file, Morris said dully, although it probably wasn't there. The Sugar Heights thing would be under seal, as he had told Andy. Fucking Andy Halliday. This is more his fault than mine. Homo.
Cafferty frowned. What did you say?
Nothing. Go on.
My file consists of last night's arrest report. The good news is that your fate will be in some other judge's hands when you come to trial. The better news, for me at least, is that by that point someone else will be representing you. My wife and I are moving to Denver, and you, Mr. Bellamy, will be just a memory.
Denver or hell, it made no difference to Morris.
Tell me what I'm charged with. You don't remember.
I was in a blackout.
Is that so?
It actually is, Morris said. Maybe he could trade the notebooks, although it hurt him to even consider it. But even if he made the offer, or if Cafferty made it, would a prosecutor grasp the importance of what was in them? It didn't seem likely. Lawyers weren't scholars.
A prosecutor's idea of great literature would probably be Earl Stanley Gardiner.
Even if the notebooks, all those beautiful moleskins, did matter to the state's legal rep, what would he, Morris, gain by turning them over? One life sentence instead of three? Whoopee ding! I can't, no matter what. I won't. Andy Halliday might have been an English leather wearing homo, but he had been right about Morris's motivation. Curtis and Freddy had been in it for cash. When Morris assured them the old guy might have squirreled away as much as 100,000, they had believed him. Rothstein's writings? To those two bumblefucks, the value of Rothstein's output since 1960 was just a misty maybe, like a lost gold mine. It was Morris who cared about the writing.
If things had gone differently, he would have offered to trade Curtis and Freddy his share of the money for the written words, and he was sure they would have taken him up on it.
If he gave that up now, especially when the notebooks contained the continuation of the Jimmy Gold saga, it would all have been for nothing.
Cafferty rapped his phone on the plexi, then put it back to his ear. Cafferty to Bellamy. Cafferty to Bellamy. Come in, Bellamy.
Sorry, I was thinking.
A little late for that, wouldn't you say? Try to stick with me, if you please. You'll be arraigned on 3 counts. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to plead not guilty to each in turn. Later, when you go to trial, you can change to guilty, should it prove to your advantage to do so. Don't even think about bail, because Bukowski doesn't laugh. She cackles like Witch Hazel.
Morris thought, this is a case of worst fears realized. Rothstein, Dow, and Rogers. 3 counts.
of Murder One. Mr. Bellamy, our time is fleeting, and I'm losing patience.
The phone sagged away from his ear, and Morris brought it back with an effort.
Nothing mattered now, and still the lawyer with the guileless Richie Cunningham face and the weird middle-aged baritone voice kept pouring words into his ear, and at some point they began to make sense.
They'll work up the ladder, Mr. Bellamy, from first to worst. Count one, resisting arrest. For arraignment purposes, you plead not guilty. Count two, aggravated assault. Not just the woman. You also got one good one in on the first responding cop before he cuffed you. You plead not guilty. Count three, aggravated rape. They may add attempted murder later, but right now it's just rape. If rape can be called just anything, I suppose. You plead.
Wait a minute, Morris said. He touched the scratches on his cheek, and what he felt was hope. I raped somebody?
Indeed you did, Cafferty said, sounding pleased. Probably because his client finally seemed to be following him. After Miss Cora Ann Hooper,
he took a sheet of paper from his briefcase and consulted it.
This was shortly after she left the diner where she works as a waitress. She was heading for a bus stop on Lower Marlboro. Says you tackled her and pulled her into an alley next to Shooter's Tavern, where you had spent several hours imbibing Jack Daniels before kicking the jukebox and being asked to leave. Miss Hooper had a battery-powered police alert in her purse and managed to trigger it. She also scratched your face. You broke her nose, held her down, choked her, and proceeded to insert your Johns Hopkins into her Sarah Lawrence. When Officer Philip Ellington hauled you off, you were still matriculating.
Rape? Why would I?
Stupid question. Why had he spent three long hours tearing up that home in Sugar Heights just taking a short break to piss on the Aubusson carpet? I have no idea, Cafferty said. Rape is foreign to my way of life.
And mine, Morris thought, ordinarily, but I was drinking Jack and got up to high jinks.
How long will they give me? The prosecution will ask for life. If you plead guilty at trial and throw yourself on the mercy of the court, you might only get 25 years.
Morris pleaded guilty at trial. He said he regretted what he'd done. He blamed the booze. He threw himself on the mercy of the court and got life. 2013 to 2014.
By the time he was a high school sophomore, Pete Saubers had already figured out the next step, a good college in New England, where literature instead of cleanliness was next to godliness. He began investigating online and collecting brochures. Emerson or BC seemed the most likely candidates, but Brown might not be out of reach. His mother and father told him not to get his hopes up, but Pete didn't buy that. He felt that if you didn't have hopes and ambitions when you were a teenager, you'd be pretty much fucked later on. About majoring in English, there was no question. Some of the surety had to do with John Rothstein and the Jimmy Gold novels. So far as Pete knew, he was the only person in the world who had read the final two, and they had changed his life. Howard Ricker, his sophomore English teacher, had also been life-changing, even though many kids made fun of him, calling him Ricky the Hippie because of the flower power shirts and bell-bottoms he favored. Pete's girlfriend, Gloria Moore, called him Pastor Ricky because he had a habit of waving his hands above his head when he got excited. Hardly anyone cut Mr. Ricker's classes, though. He was entertaining. He was enthusiastic. And unlike many of the teachers, he seemed to genuinely like the kids, whom he called my young ladies and gentlemen. They rolled their eyes at his retro clothes and his screechy laugh, but the clothes had a certain funky cachet. And the screechy laugh was so amiably weird it made you want to laugh along. On the first day of sophomore English, he blew in like a cool breeze, welcomed them, and then printed something on the board that Pete Saubers never forgot. This is stupid. What do you make of this, ladies and gentlemen? He asked. What on earth can it mean? The class was silent.
I'll tell you then. It happens to be the most common criticism made by young ladies and gentlemen such as yourselves, doomed to a course where we begin with excerpts from Beowulf and end with Raymond Carver. Among teachers, such survey courses are sometimes called GTTG, Gallop Through the Glories.
He screeched cheerfully, also waggling his hands at shoulder height in a yowza yowza gesture. Most of the kids laughed along, Pete among them.
Class verdict on Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal? This is stupid. Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne? This is stupid. Mending Wall by Robert Frost? This is moderately stupid. The required excerpt from Moby Dick? This is extremely stupid.
More laughter. None of them had read Moby Dick, but they all knew it was hard and boring. Stupid, in other words.
And sometimes, Mr. Ricker exclaimed, raising one finger and pointing dramatically at the words on the blackboard,
sometimes, my young ladies and gentlemen, the criticism is spot on.
I stand here with my bare face hanging out and admit it. I am required to teach certain antiquities I would rather not teach.
I see the loss of enthusiasm in your eyes, and my soul groans.
Yes, groans. But I soldier on because I know that much of what I teach is not stupid.
Even some of the antiquities to which you feel you cannot relate now or ever will have deep resonance that will eventually reveal itself.
Shall I tell you how you judge the not stupid from the is stupid?
Shall I impart this great secret? Since we have 40 minutes left in this class and as yet no grist to grind in the mill of our combined intellects, I believe I will.
He leaned forward and propped his hands on the desk, his tie swinging like a pendulum. Pete felt that Mr. Ricker was looking directly at him, as if he knew, or at least intuited, the tremendous secret Pete was keeping under a pile of blankets in the attic of his house, something far more important than money. At some point in this course, perhaps even tonight, you will read something difficult, something you only partially understand, and your verdict will be, this is stupid.
Will I argue when you advance that opinion in class the next day?
Why would I do such a useless thing?
My time with you is short, only 34 weeks of classes, and I will not waste it arguing about the merits of this short story or that poem. Why would I, when all such opinions are subjective, and no final resolution can ever be reached? Some of the kids, Gloria was one of them, now looked lost, but Pete understood exactly what Mr. Ricker, a.k.a. Ricky the Hippie, was talking about, because since starting the notebooks, he had read dozens of critical essays on John Rothstein. Many of them judged Rothstein to be one of the greatest American writers of the 20th century, right up there with Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Faulkner, and Roth. There were others, a minority but a vocal one, who asserted that his work was second-rate and hollow. Pete had read a piece in Salon where the writer had called Rothstein king of the wise crack and the patron saint of fools.
Time is the answer, Mr. Ricker said on the first day of Pete's sophomore year. He strode back and forth, antique bell-bottoms swishing, occasionally waving his arms.
Yes! Time mercilessly culls away the is-stupid from the not-stupid.
It is a natural Darwinian process. It is why the novels of Graham Greene are available in every good bookstore and the novels of Somerset Maugham are not. Those novels still exist, of course, but you must order them, and you would only do that if you knew about them. Most modern readers do not. Raise your hand if you have ever heard of Somerset Maugham, and I'll spell that for you.
No hands went up. Mr. Ricker nodded. Rather grimly, it seemed to Pete.
Time has decreed that Mr. Green is not stupid, while Mr. Maugham is, well, not exactly stupid, but forgettable.
He wrote some very fine novels, in my opinion.
The Moon and Sixpence is remarkable, my young ladies and gentlemen. Remarkable. and he also wrote a great deal of excellent short fiction, but none is included in your textbook. Shall I weep over this? Shall I rage and shake my fists and proclaim injustice? No, I will not. Such culling is a natural process. It will occur for you, young ladies and gentlemen, although I will be in your rearview mirror by the time it happens. Shall I tell you how it happens? You will read something, perhaps Dulce et Decorum Est by Wilfred Owen. Shall we use that as an example? Why not? Then, in a deeper voice that sent chills up Pete's back and tightened his throat, Mr. Ricker cried, "Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge." And so on, cetera, cetera. Some of you will say, "This is stupid." Well, I break my promise not to argue the point, even though I consider Mr. Owen's poems the greatest to come out of World War I. No, it's just my opinion, you see, and opinions are like assholes, everybody has one. They all roared at that, young ladies and gentlemen alike. Mr. Ricker drew himself up. "I may give some of you detentions if you disrupt my class. I have no problem with imposing discipline, but never will I disrespect your opinion." And yet, up went the finger. "Time will pass. Tempest will fugit. Owen's poem may fall away from your mind, in which case your verdict of is stupid will have turned out to be correct, for you, at least. But for some of you, it will recur, and recur, and recur. Each time it does, the steady march of your maturity will deepen its resonance. Each time that poem steals back into your mind, it will seem a little less stupid and a little more vital, a little more important, until it shines, young ladies and gentlemen, until it shines." Thus endeth my opening day peroration, and I ask you to turn to page 16 in that most excellent tome, Language and Literature. One of the stories Mr. Ricker assigned that year was The Rocking Horse Winner by D.H. Lawrence, and sure enough, many of Mr. Ricker's young ladies and gentlemen, including Gloria Moore, of whom Pete was growing tired in spite of her really excellent breasts, considered it stupid. Pete did not, in large part because events in his life had already caused him to mature beyond his years. As 2013 gave way to 2014, the year of the famed polar vortex, when furnaces all over the upper Midwest went into maximum overdrive, burning money by the bale, that story recurred to him often, and its resonance continued to deepen and recur. The family in it seemed to have everything, but they didn't. There was never quite enough, and the hero of the story, a young boy named Paul, always heard the house whispering, "There must be more money. There must be more money." Pete Saubers guessed that there were kids who considered that stupid. They were the lucky ones who had never been forced to listen to nightly arky-barkies about which bills to pay or the price of cigarettes. The young protagonist in the Lawrence story discovered a supernatural way to make money. By riding his toy rocking horse to the make-believe land of luck, Paul could pick horse race winners in the real world. He made thousands of dollars, and still the house whispered, "There must be more money." After one final epic ride on the rocking horse and one final big money pick, Paul dropped dead of a brain hemorrhage or something. Pete didn't have so much as a headache after finding the buried trunk, but it was still his rocking horse, wasn't it? Yes, his very own rocking horse. But by 2013, the year he met Mr. Ricker, the rocking horse was slowing down. The trunk money had almost run out. It had gotten his parents through a rough and scary patch when their marriage might otherwise have crashed and burned. This Pete knew, and he never once regretted playing guardian angel. In the words of that old song, the trunk money had formed a bridge over troubled waters, and things were better, much, on the other side. The worst of the recession was over. Mom was teaching full time again, her salary $3,000 a year better than before.
Dad now ran his own small business. Not real estate exactly, but something called Real Estate Search. He had several agencies in the city as clients. Pete didn't completely understand how it worked, but he knew it was actually making some money, and might make more in the years ahead if the housing market continued to trend upward. He was agenting a few properties of his own, too. Best of all, he was drug-free and walking well. The crutches had been in the closet for over a year, and he only used his cane on rainy or snowy days when his bones and joints ached. All good. Great, in fact. And yet, as Mr. Ricker said at least once in every class, and yet... There was Tina to think about. That was one very large and yet. Many of her friends from the old neighborhood on the west side, including Barbara Robinson, whom Tina had idolized, were going to Chapel Ridge, a private school that had an excellent record when it came to sending kids on to good colleges. Mom had told Tina that she and Dad didn't see how they could afford to send her there directly from middle school. Maybe she could attend as a sophomore if their finances continued to improve. "But I won't know anybody by then," Tina had said, starting to cry. "You'll know Barbara Robinson," Mom said, and Pete, listening from the next room, could tell from the sound of her voice that Mom was on the verge of tears herself. Hilda and Betsy, too. But teens had been a little younger than those girls, and Pete knew only Barb's had been a real friend to his sister back in the West Side days. Hilda Carver and Betsy DeWitt probably didn't even remember her. Neither would Barbara in another year or two. Their mother didn't seem to remember what a big deal high school was and how quickly you forgot your little kid friends once you got there. Tina's response summed up these thoughts with admirable succinctness. "Yeah, but they won't know me." "Tina, you have that money," Tina cried. "That mystery money that comes every month. Why can't I have some for Chapel Ridge?" "Because we're still catching up from the bad time, honey." To this, Tina could say nothing, because it was true. His own college plans were another, and yet. Pete knew that to some of his friends, maybe most of them, college seemed as far away as the outer planets of the solar system. But if he wanted a good one, Brown, his mind whispered, English lit at Brown. That meant making early applications when he was a first-semester senior. The applications themselves cost money, as did the summer class he needed to pick up if he wanted to score at least a 670 on the math part of the SATs. He had a part-time job at the Garner Street Library, but 35 bucks a week didn't go far. Dad's business had grown enough to make a downtown office desirable. That was, and yet, number three. Just a low-rent place on an upper floor and being close to the action would pay dividends, but it would mean laying out more money, and Pete knew, even though no one said it out loud, that Dad was counting on the mystery cash to carry him through the critical period. They had all come to depend on the mystery cash, and only Pete knew it would be gone before the end of 14. And yeah, okay, he had spent some on himself. Not a huge amount, that would have raised questions, but 100 here and 100 there, a blazer and a pair of loafers for the class trip to Washington, a few CDs, and books. He had become a fool for books since reading The Notebooks and falling in love with John Rothstein. He began with Rothstein's Jewish contemporaries like Philip Roth, Saul Bellow, and Irwin Shaw. He thought The Young Lions was fucking awesome and couldn't understand why it wasn't a classic, and spread out from there. He always bought paperbacks, but even those were $12 or $15 apiece these days unless you could find them used. The Rocking Horse Winner had resonance, all right. Big-time resonance, because Pete could hear his own house whispering, "There must be more money." And all too soon, there would be less. But money wasn't all the trunk had contained, was it? That was another and yet. One Pete Saubers thought about more and more as time passed. For his end-of-year research paper in Mr. Ricker's Gallop Through the Glories, Pete did a 16-page analysis of the Jimmy Gold trilogy, quoting from various reviews and adding in stuff from the few interviews Rothstein had given before retreating to his farm in New Hampshire and going completely dark.
He finished by talking about Rothstein's tour of the German death camps as a reporter for the New York Herald, this 4 years before publishing the first Jimmy Gold book. "I believe that was the most important event of Mr. Rothstein's life," Pete wrote, "surely the most important event of his life as a writer. Jimmy's search for meaning always goes back to what Mr. Rothstein saw in those camps, and it's why, when Jimmy tries to live the life of an ordinary American citizen, he always feels hollow. For me, this is best expressed when he throws an ashtray through the TV and the runner slows down. He does it during a CBS News special about the Holocaust." When Mr. Ricker returned their papers, a big A+ was scrawled on Pete's cover, which was a computer-scanned photo of Rothstein as a young man sitting in Sardi's with Ernest Hemingway. Below the A+, Mr. Ricker had written, "See me after class." When the other kids were gone, Mr. Ricker looked at Pete so fixedly that Pete was momentarily scared his favorite teacher was going to accuse him of plagiarism. Then Mr. Ricker smiled. "That is the best student paper I've read in my 28 years of teaching, because it was the most confident and the most deeply felt." Pete's face heated with pleasure. "Thanks. Really. Thanks a lot." "I'd argue with your conclusion, though," Mr. Ricker said, leaning back in his chair and lacing his fingers together behind his neck. "The characterization of Jimmy as a noble American hero like Huck Finn is not supported by the concluding book of the trilogy. Yes, he throws an ashtray at the television screen, but it's not an act of heroism. The CBS logo is an eye, you know, and Jimmy's act is a ritual blinding of his inner eye, the one that sees the truth. That's not my insight. It's an almost direct quote from an essay called The Runner Turns Away by John Crow Ransom. Leslie Fiedler says much the same in Love and Death in the American Novel. But I'm not trying to debunk you, Pete. I'm just saying you need to follow the evidence of any book wherever it leads, and that means not omitting crucial developments that run counter to your thesis. What does Jimmy do after he throws the ashtray through the TV, and after his wife delivers her classic line, 'You bastard, how will the kids watch Mickey Mouse now?' He goes out and buys another TV set, but not just any TV set, but the first color TV set on the block. And then he creates the big successful ad campaign for Does He Do Household Cleaner, but..." Mr. Ricker raised his eyebrows, waiting for the but. And how could Pete tell him that a year later, Jimmy steals into the agency late one night with matches and a can of kerosene? That Rothstein foreshadows all the protests about Vietnam and civil rights by having Jimmy start a fire that pretty much destroys the building known as the Temple of Advertising? That he hitchhikes out of New York City without a look back, leaving his family behind and striking out for the territory just like Huck and Jim? He couldn't say any of that because it was the story told in The Runner Goes West, a novel that existed only in 17 closely written notebooks that had lain buried in an old trunk for over 30 years. "Go ahead and butt me your butts," Mr. Ricker said equably. "There's nothing I like better than a good book discussion with someone who can hold up his end of the argument. I imagine you've already missed your bus, but I'll be more than happy to give you a ride home." He tapped the cover sheet of Pete's paper. Johnny R. and Ernie H., those twin titans of American literature with oversized martini glasses raised in a toast. "Unsupported conclusion aside, which I put down to a touching desire to see light at the end of an extremely dark final novel, this is extraordinary work. Just extraordinary. So go for it. Butt me your butts." "But nothing, I guess," Pete said. "You could be right. Only Mr. Ricker wasn't. Any doubt about Jimmy Gold's capacity to sell out that remained at the end of The Runner Goes West was swept away in the last and longest novel of the series, The Runner Raises the Flag. It was the best book Pete had ever read, also the saddest."
"In your paper, you didn't go into how Rothstein died."
"No."
"May I ask why not?"
"Because it didn't fit the theme, I guess, and it would have made the paper too long. Also, well, It was such a bummer for him to die that way, getting killed in a stupid burglary. He shouldn't have kept cash in the house, Mr. Ricker said mildly. But he did, and a lot of people knew it. Don't judge him too harshly for that. Many writers have been stupid and improvident about money. Charles Dickens found himself supporting a family of slackers, including his own father. Samuel Clemens was all but bankrupted by bad real estate transactions. Arthur Conan Doyle lost thousands of dollars to fake mediums and spent thousands more on fake photos of fairies. At least Rothstein's major work was done. Unless you believe, as some people do. Pete looked at his watch. Mr. Ricker, I can still catch my bus if I hurry. Mr. Ricker did that funny yowza yowza thing with his hands. Go, by all means, go. I just wanted to thank you for such a wonderful piece of work, and to offer a friendly caution. When you approach this kind of thing next year, and in college, don't let your good nature cloud your critical eye. The critical eye should always be cold and clear. I won't, Pete said, and hurried out. The last thing he wanted to discuss with Mr. Ricker was the possibility that the thieves who had taken John Rothstein's life had stolen a bunch of unpublished manuscripts as well as money, and maybe destroyed them after deciding they had no value. Once or twice, Pete had played with the idea of turning the notebooks over to the police, even though that would almost surely mean his parents would find out where the mystery money had been coming from. The notebooks were, after all, evidence of a crime as well as a literary treasure. But it was an old crime, ancient history. Better to leave well enough alone. Right?